Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. The Rules of Investing gets inside the minds of leading investors, economists, and industry experts, and it's brought to you by Livewire Markets. Today's guest is Sam Granger, Portfolio Manager at Totus Capital. After starting his career covering small and micro-cap equities at Naos Asset Management, Sam moved to Totus in 2014 while the firm was still young. Not long after moving to Totus, he was given a small amount of seed capital, allowing him to start what eventually became the Totus High Conviction Fund. In this episode, we discuss idea generation strategies for covering a large investment universe with limited resources. He tells us why he doesn't engage in short selling, and he shares two stocks with big futures. If you're an Apple Podcasts or Spotify user, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss an episode. Or if you're a Livewire subscriber, hit the follow button at the bottom of the wire to be notified whenever I post content. Not a Livewire subscriber yet? Just head on over to livewiremarkets.com. It's free, easy to register, and you'll get access to insights from the leading investment minds in the country. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Sam, welcome to the show. It's good to have you on.
Mate, great to be here. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so it's great to have me on. Thank you.
Oh, that's awesome to hear. I have to ask you, what's been your favorite episode recently? I've really enjoyed a few of our recent chats, but curious to get a perspective from a listener.
Ah, you put me on the spot here.
I did, yeah.
I'm a big fan of Anthony Abood at Perpetual, so I think I enjoyed that discussion. He's a good stock picker and a funny guy, so I enjoy listening to Anthony.
That's a really good choice. Actually, that is my most popular episode ever. It's had more than 16,000 downloads since we I think part of it might have been the timing. We talked about what to buy in a market crash, and it came out just as the market crashed. So there was a bit of fortuitous timing there. But yeah, as you said, it was a really, really interesting chat, and he's a really interesting guy. But let's talk a little bit about you and your experience as an investor. I understand that you've got a bit of a family background in the industry. I'd be curious to hear a little bit about that. Could you tell me maybe some of your early experiences as an investor, and how did they shape your philosophy and your strategy today?
Sure. So, yeah, my father has worked in and run broking firms in Sydney, stockbroking firms, for a number of years, and my uncle also worked and still works in the industry. So I sort of always wanted to go into finance and financial markets without really knowing what that meant when I was a bit younger. But Dad's specialty was small cap mining, and he invested a lot in that space and raised a lot of money for those companies. And I think I sort of realized the thrills and spills of that market probably weren't for me psychologically and my temperament, but it really sort of whet my appetite for finance generally. So I studied commerce at Sydney University, and then was lucky enough to get an internship at a place called Naos Asset Management while I was at uni. And those guys are great investors. They invest in the microcap end of the market in a concentrated fashion. And I think those two things, investing in small caps where it's a bit less competitive and investing in a concentrated fashion, are two things that really resonated with me at a young age working with those guys, and something that I've continued to do. And then in 2014, joined Totus Capital. I think Totus is known for Ben McGarry and the Alpha Fund. So that fund was $12 million funds under management when I joined. It is now a $220 million fund 5 or 6 years later. So things have gone really well there with Ben. But I think the big influential thing that happened to me at Totus quite early on was Ben was kind enough to give me $50,000 of his own capital to invest however I saw fit. And he said, you know, do what you want with this money, but I'm going to judge your performance at Totus based on how you go with my $50,000 and, you know, develop your own philosophy, work out what works for you, make some mistakes. And that's really what I did. And it was just an awesome experience investing someone else's capital and being entrusted with someone else's capital at such a young age. And through that process, I think I really arrived at a philosophy largely built on the Munger and Buffett buy great businesses and hold them forever, you know, buy businesses with moat and runway for growth. And that morphed into the Totus High Conviction Fund, which we launched in 2017. So that's a concentrated portfolio of equities, 10 to 15 businesses, really high quality assets, purchased at attractive prices and held for the long term. So yeah, been running that fund for more than 3.5 years now and really enjoying it.
Well, certainly all investors, regardless of how experienced you are, we're always working on some things. But I'm curious, you know, as a younger investor, what are some of the areas that you still feel like, you know, this is something that I want to improve on and get better at?
Yeah, you're always working on all parts of your investing at all times. As you said, you know, this job is never finished and you're never done learning. You're always learning, which is one of the great things about the job. I think a big focus for me over the past 12 months has really been improving my tech literacy and really upskilling myself and understanding software businesses and cloud computing and where all that is going and what the innovators in the US are really doing. And I think that's imperative for a couple of reasons. Number one, you can obviously invest in those assets, which is a great idea if the prices make sense. And number two, these businesses are really disrupting a number of ASX listed companies. And I think even if you don't want to invest in them, it's imperative to understand what they're doing, how they're doing it, and how it's going to impact all types of businesses you might look at. So yeah, really understanding technology, listening to podcasts, listening to reading newsletters, understanding what is going on in that space has probably been the biggest focus for me in terms of upskilling myself of late.
You mentioned Ben McGarry, of course, the founder of Totus, the firm that you work at, who has actually been on the show before. That was a very fun episode. Ben is, of course, well known as a short seller. He's had some pretty public shorts that he's discussed. On the other hand, I know that that's something that you don't actually engage in at all. I'm curious, having Ben there, who is, you know, I mean, he's not just a short seller. I don't want to give the impression that's the only thing he does. He is a long short manager. But why is it that you don't engage in the short selling at all?
Yeah, it's a good question. So Ben is a great short seller. And, you know, I worked on shorts with Ben for 3 or 4 years at Totus. And now 99% of my time is spent on long investments for both the High Conviction Fund and the Alpha Fund. I sort of decided I didn't want to do shorts because, you know, stocks go up through time and, you know, look at 10-year rolling returns, 20-year rolling returns, 50-year, 100-year, 200-year rolling returns, and stocks will give you 6 or 7% a year in return. And why is that? It's because businesses pay dividend yields and they retain earnings to reinvest in their business and they grow their businesses. So to make money on a short, you have to add substantial alpha just to break even. And that is possible, but tricky. And Ben's done a great job at that, but it's a harder game. The other issue with shorts is shorts get bigger in your portfolio as they move against you. And it's the opposite of long. So if I have a long investment that goes wrong, the stock price goes down and it gets smaller in my portfolio, which just makes it a lot easier to manage. I think shorts have a huge place in people's portfolios, and Ben's developed a very successful track record in business short selling. And I think what shorts give you is they give you an uncorrelated return profile. And that's really important because equities will give you 6 or 7%, as I said, but those returns are lumpy and they'll come in ebbs and flows. And shorting, for people that can't bear that volatility or can't psychologically don't want to bear that volatility, it's a really great tool, shorting stocks.
Yeah, I imagine over the last few months, as we've experienced some pretty wild volatility in both directions, it would have helped to smooth that out a little bit. Having Ben in the office, I imagine he brings a somewhat unique kind of perspective to your investing. What value has it brought to you as a portfolio manager having someone in the office that has those skills?
Yeah, it's been really good. I think the big one is you look at the pattern recognition of what works on the short side. And if I look at our best shorts, they're typically businesses with very weak accounting, poor cash flow. They're making acquisitions to hide poor organic growth. The working capital is building. You know, they've changed their revenue recognition policy because they're trying to hide revenue holes. All these little accounting tricks. And that was a massive part of what we do on the short side. And I think the value that brings to the high conviction fund and the process in the high conviction fund is that's built into our due diligence process when we look at longs. So, you know, we're reading notes to accounts, we're reconciling cash flow, we're looking at working capital movements, we're checking organic growth, ex acquisitions. All these little things you do just increase your hit rate because you're less likely to make a mistake by investing in a business where there's problems that might be emerging in the accounts.
I know a lot of fund managers will say, don't focus on short-term performance. Most of the time when they're saying that, though, it's usually because their short-term performance is not very good. I saw recently something that I thought was interesting, which was you making that point despite having quite good performance over the last 12 months. Why is it that you think about it in this way? Like, why are you so focused on people not looking at your short-term performance even when it's good?
Yeah, I think it's simply because I've studied the history of funds management and every great investor ever has had periods of underperformance. So, you know, there's no reason I won't be exactly the same. And I've had periods of underperformance in the past. So, you know, I really want investors who are on this journey with me for the next 20 years. I want to run the high conviction fund for the next 20 years. And I think key to that is having the right investor base who understand that performance will ebb and flow. And ultimately, it's a long-term game and we're trying to add alpha over the long term, acknowledging that we can't outperform over every short term period.
Yeah, I'll probably get some of the numbers wrong because I am quoting off the top of my head. But I recall reading some research a while ago, which looked at fund managers with very long term outperformance. So, you know, who produce significant alpha over periods of 10, 15, 20 years. And what they found was that all of those managers, without exception, had gone through significant periods where they were in the bottom decile of performance overall. So like 3 to 5 year periods, sometimes even where they significantly underperform the market, to the point where it almost seems like that those periods of underperformance seem to be a prerequisite for the long-term outperformance rather than the downside of long-term outperformance, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think you've touched on an important point there. To get a lot of alpha, I think you have to do something really different. And that means you'll diverge quite significantly from the index at different times. And so I think that's part and parcel of running a concentrated portfolio and trying to get alpha.
What do you think actually is a reasonable period of performance, a reasonable period to judge performance over then?
I'd say 3 years minimum, you know, the longer the better, but 3 years minimum. I think the key here is you want to judge performance through a few different types of markets. So ideally a bull market and a bear market, because, you know, we've all seen people who buy geared businesses or take some extra risk in bull markets and look clever and then get caught out in a bear market. So yeah, 3 years minimum and some different types of markets just to check how people are actually doing it.
I understand that the strategy of your fund has changed a little bit over the last few years since you launched it with that $50,000 of seed capital. Oh, how long ago was that now?
So that was mid-2014. It was launched with $50,000 internal capital and then was formalized in January 2017 with some external investors and is now sort of $11 million funds under management 3.5 years later.
Yeah, I thought I had the 2017 was the number in my head. That's where I've got it from. But I understand that you have kind of evolved and changed the strategy a bit over that time. Could you maybe explain a little bit about what has changed and why you decided to change it?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say the strategy has changed. Well, we're still looking to buy fantastic businesses at attractive prices and hold those for the long term. What you might be referring to is the asset allocation to offshore stocks has increased through that time. So we've got a very flexible mandate where we can invest in Australia and we can invest globally and we can invest in small caps and we can invest in mega caps. And so that asset allocation has gone from about 10% offshore businesses when we launched to about 50% offshore businesses. And that is simply just a function of the opportunity set. So we're finding better businesses at more attractive prices in the offshore market and we can follow those opportunities because we're not constrained by our mandate, which I think is really important. I also think that the scarcity of really good growth stocks in Australia has really has really led some of the better businesses in Australia to be bid up to incredibly expensive prices relative to offshore peers. And so our shift offshore is really just a function of that, I think.
You're part of a fairly small team. And as you just kind of pointed to there, you cover a pretty wide universe of stocks, not just in Australia, looking at small caps and micro caps, which is a pretty big universe in and of itself, but also once you add in those overseas stocks, obviously that becomes very large. I imagine covering such a huge universe of stocks like that with a small team must present a few challenges, not dissimilar to some of the challenges that everyday retail investors face, no doubt. What are some of the efficient methods that you've developed to try and generate ideas and filter that list down for further research so that you're really focusing on the best possible opportunities?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because it's a big part of our job, trying to allocate time to ideas and working out where to spend your time to find the most prospective ideas. And there's really no silver bullet there, unfortunately. I've got a good network in Australia. You know, my brothers work in the industry. My brother Tom runs a fund with Acacia Capital called the Wattle Fund, and my brother Will works at Airlie. So I think having a network really helps. I think one thing that retail investors should think more about, I think, is leveraging the IP of other great investors. You know, funds management's a bit strange in that the world's best investors are putting their best ideas in their monthly or their quarterly and putting it on their website. So I can see what Hamish at Magellan is doing. I can see what Robert VGI is doing. I can often see what Warren Buffett is doing. I think leverage that IP. They're some of the world's great investors, and use that as a springboard to do your own research. So, you know, we always do our own research, and I would never buy a stock just because they bought it. But I think why not focus on businesses that other great investors have already said they like. You know, and Apple is the great example here. So Buffett bought Apple, I think it was 2016, or maybe 2015. And this is a business, you know, we use every day in our lives. He's made a huge commitment to that business, a massive swing. And you could have gone 3 or 4 times your money just following Buffett into Apple, or at least doing the research when he got in. So I think use that unique feature of funds management, use that free IP that's just sitting there, and use that as a springboard to do your own research.
The point that you touched on there is actually a big part of how Livewire developed into the business it is today. We recognized that fund managers were putting all this great information, whether it be stock ideas or macroeconomic research or even just educational information. A lot of fund managers put some really, really great educational content in their updates, and it just wasn't getting seen by people. It wasn't getting read by people. So we decided to tap into that resource and start getting some of that content onto Livewire to give people things to read, to give our audience things to read. And that was kind of a pretty important part of how we got to where we are today. And it's still, you know, if you look on Livewire now, you're going to see a lot of content from different fund managers talking about their asset allocation. You can learn about the stocks that they invest in. You can get educational content from them. So I hope the audience will excuse me for my 2.5 minute spruik of our services, but I thought it lined up directly with what you were saying there.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think people have a bias towards wanting to sound really original. And I think you always have to do your own research, but I think the best ideas don't have to be original ideas. You've just got to find the best risk-reward opportunities for your investors.
Well, let's start talking a little bit about some of those stocks. I know you're a stock picker, so no doubt this is the bit of the interview that you would have been looking forward to. You talked a little bit about how you have increasingly found additional opportunities offshore rather than buying as many onshore over the last few years. Could you maybe share an example of one of those global companies that you uncovered and explain a bit to us about what drew you to it in the first place?
Sure. So maybe I'll talk about Spotify, which is a business that won't be as well known by some of your listeners.
Well, we're actually on Spotify, so some of our listeners no doubt know it well.
That's a very good point. Yep. Okay. So Spotify was pitched to Ben and I by a well-known Sydney investor, and it was in their top five holdings, and they said, have a look at this business. And so I respect this guy. So I went away and read the prospectus, and my initial concerns were, you know, where's the moat? Because everyone has the same music catalog and everyone's got the same songs, and you're competing against Apple and Amazon and Google. So, you know, it's a great product, but it's undifferentiated, and where's the moat? And my second concern was, you know, there's three labels that control about 85% of the music industry, the recorded music industry. So you've got a consolidated supply base, and it's very difficult to earn great margins when you've got a powerful supply base, and Spotify's gross margins are quite low. So I was sort of concerned about those two issues, but respect this investor. So I went away and spent 3 or 4 weeks looking at the business in more detail, and I discovered I was completely wrong about both of those points. I think Spotify's got a really deep moat. If you speak to users of Spotify, they're high intensity users, and they don't switch once they've committed to a service and they've built playlists. The service is hugely sticky once it's gotten to know you and its song recommendation engine improves. The service really improves the more you use it. So in that sense, you know, all my mates have picked a music streaming service and have stuck to it. And then the second point was the consolidated supply base. If you actually dig into the data, Spotify's rapidly fragmenting that supply base. Those top three labels were 87% of music streams 3 years ago. They're now 82% of streams. And I think that's just a function of the fact that independents are gaining share on Spotify because they aren't held back by radio and the traditional gatekeepers that were required to break songs. So I think Spotify's margins can hugely expand. I think they've got a great product with a deep moat. And I think the business was very cheap when we looked at it about 12 or 18 months ago. So that's been a big contributor for us recently.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about what you see in the future for Spotify? Looking out over, say, the next 5 years, what do you see playing out for the business, both in terms of the soft aspect of it? How do you think it changes and evolves its products and services? But I'd also be keen to hear a little bit about what your expectations are in terms of growth and margins and things like that.
Sure. So I think the thing you need to understand is Spotify's attacking huge end markets. So there's sort of two different businesses. There's a premium business, which is paid music and podcasts, and that's probably only 10% penetrated. There's 3.5 billion active smartphones in the world. Only about 300 million have premium subscriptions to music. So we think penetration will go north of 70% there, and that's a really long runway for growth. And Spotify is the market leader. They're adding more subs than their three nearest competitors combined. So they're taking a huge chunk of that massive market. And then the second business is an ad-supported business, which is the same service essentially, but you have to listen to ads and you don't have to pay. So that's really attacking the radio ad market. So radio ads are still a $20 billion US market. In the US, it's still a big market. In Australia and in the rest of the developed world, Spotify has less than $1 billion of revenue there. So that's a 20x opportunity. They're investing in things like podcasts to beef up their attack of that market. And we think they can take a huge chunk of it through time. It's a better product, digital ads customized to whoever is listening to the podcast or to the song. So two massive end markets. And then I think margins can expand from 25% to 35%. For some of the reasons I outlined earlier, I think they're diluting their supply base, and I think they're going to sell a lot of services back into that record label base, things like song recommendation. So if I want to break a new artist, the way I do that is I can push a recommendation to a Spotify user who has a tendency to like the kind of music this artist produces and say, here's a song recommendation, would you like to listen? That person listens to the song, likes the artist, follows them on Spotify. That's hugely valuable to the artist. It's hugely valuable to the label that supports the artist. And Spotify has yet to really monetize any of that. So I think it's just massive monetization opportunities. Yeah, so gross margins expanding from 25% to 35%, operating leverage and a huge revenue opportunity. You know, I think there's plenty of upside to Spotify on a five-year view.
Well, let's talk a little bit closer to home then. I see looking at a recent update that one of your top holdings is Objective Corp, which is having a pretty incredible year to say the least. It was up when I was looking about four times over the last 12 months. I don't think the stock is particularly widely known. So maybe just as a starting point, could you tell us a little bit about what the company does and why you're drawn to it?
Objective's been a huge contributor to the fund historically, and it's still our largest position. So, you know, we're still really bullish about Objective. They sell enterprise content management software into local, state, and federal government. So that's software which helps governments comply with the Records Act, and they need to keep our documents and our data stored in a very specific way, and Objective Corp helps them meet that requirement. So why did we like Objective when we bought it 24 months ago? It's really that combination of an amazing business and an amazing manager. So the business itself is probably one of the highest quality revenue streams on the ASX, in my view. They're selling software into governments, hugely diversified by customer. A lot, 75% of the revenue is recurring, so it just turns up each year. The customer churn is less than 2% a year. So customers implement the software. It's very sticky. They don't leave. So you're effectively bolting on annuity revenue streams. And then from the management perspective, you've got a guy there, Tony Walls, who founded the business, still owns 66% of it, pays himself $220,000 a year, has bought back 30% of the shares on issue since he listed the business, and has made all sorts of clever bolt-ons and strategic moves to increase shareholder value. So it's that combination of amazing business, amazing manager, and then we bought that business at something like 17 times free cash flow, which was a market multiple for a far better than market business. That was a bit of a no-brainer, we thought at the time, and you know, things have gone really well since.
Well, given the significant price appreciation, do you think there's still upside remains in the stock?
Yeah, we do. And as I said, it's still the largest position in the high conviction fund. The key thing to understand here is the revenue model transition the business has been going through. So they used to sell upfront licenses, and that was about $7 million of revenue. That's been wound back to about $1 million a year in revenue, and they've replaced that upfront license with subscription annuity payments. And what that means is they've had a substantial headwind as those licenses have run down. But now that they're through that transition, you should get very high incremental margins on a largely fixed cost base. So we think the earnings growth could be quite explosive from here. And I think that's part of the reason the share price has run up, is people are starting to recognize that fact. Yeah, so we think it can grow into its market cap quite fast from an earnings perspective. And then if I think personally about some of the biggest mistakes I've made in investing, it was selling businesses like Appen and Altium far too early. I think when you've got a great business with a great manager, you want to hold those businesses even when they look a bit expensive on near-term PEs. Part of that is when you've got these types of managers, they're often investing in new products and new markets that you're not really even aware of, and they're doing other strategic moves and creating all the shareholder value, all this optionality, which is running through the P&L, but not necessarily reflected in the earnings expectations. So I think, you know, you just want to be really careful selling these great businesses, because often you never get a chance to buy back in.
Yes, yes. That's one I've certainly learnt the hard way a couple of times, unfortunately.
Me too.
I'm curious if there's any other ideas in your portfolio at the moment you'd be willing to share that maybe have a few of those same features that you've been discussing there, but maybe you're a little bit earlier on in the development.
Mate, I'd love to give you a new Objective Corp. I don't have one at the moment. The market's pretty efficient, and I think this goes to why it's a high conviction fund, because you need to swing quite aggressively when you find a great opportunity like Objective. So we made that a 12.5% position at cost because, yeah, the market's efficient and you're not going to find those every day or every week. And if you are finding that many opportunities, you probably don't know what a good opportunity looks like, because they just shouldn't be that easy to find. You know, so we're turning over stones. We're working very hard to find them, and these things do turn up. But yeah, I don't have a new one at the moment. Sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. There's a good lesson there anyway. You know, as you said, these kind of ideas don't come along very often, and you got to appreciate them when they do.
Yeah.
Well, that's the end of the main part of our interview. But as a regular listener, I'm sure you're aware that we have three favorite questions that I like to ask every one of my guests. So we've got a few minutes left, so we'll jump into those now.
Cool.
Could you share something that, with us that you've read, watched, or listened to recently that you thought was really interesting or which taught you something valuable?
Yeah. So I just read a book called The Seven Powers by Hamilton Helmer. Hamilton is an investor. He's got an amazing long-term track record, and he's also a teacher at Stanford and has advised companies like Spotify and Netflix. And so his book, The Seven Powers, is really about seven business moats and the seven moats that exist that allow businesses to earn high returns on capital for extended periods of time. That part wasn't so new. I think we've all heard discussions of moats before and understand things like switching costs and network effects and brands and all of that. What was interesting was he talks a lot about the how and when of moat creation. And his thesis is, if you can get into businesses when they're building a moat, yet the moat isn't necessarily evident in the financial statements yet because they're reinvesting, then that's when you really get differential returns on capital invested and you really get high returns. You know, it makes you think of things like Xero and things like Spotify, where I think the moats are very deep and the reported earnings probably don't reflect the true profitability and scope of those moats. So yeah, that was a really interesting read.
Excellent. As always, I'll put a link up on the wire for this podcast. So if you head to livewiremarkets.com and click on the headline that corresponds with this podcast, you'll be able to find a link there to that book. If you're just listening and don't want to go back to the website, just repeat that for you. It's Seven Powers, The Foundations of Business Strategy by Hamilton Helmer. Next question. If you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give yourself one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
Yeah, I think read earlier. You know, when I first joined the industry, I thought, you know, there's no edge to be gotten in reading something like the Buffett letters. You know, these letters sit on the Berkshire Hathaway website. They've been there for years. Surely everyone reads them. Surely everyone understands it. And surely everyone's already investing that way. And the more I got into the industry, the more I realized people haven't actually read this stuff and haven't committed the time to do that. And there's actually a massive edge in really just listening to what great fund managers say about businesses and say about what works in the market. So, you know, reading the Buffett letters really changed my financial life, I think. And I would have read those a bit earlier if I had my time again.
Yeah, I have a sneaking suspicion that I'll never be able to confirm that a lot more people recommend the Buffett letters than have actually read them.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. It's a big time commitment and people just don't want to do it. And I think they assume there's no edge there. And I think there's a bigger edge there than people think.
For sure. Last question. And as you know, I always like to insert a little bit of a disclaimer here. Don't try this at home. We're not actually suggesting to anybody that you go out there and put all of your money in a single stock and forget about it for 5 years. This is supposed to be a little bit of an exercise in long-term thinking and hopefully a little bit of fun. So, with that being said, if markets were going to close for the next 5 years, starting from tomorrow, and you could only own shares in a single company, what would it be?
Yeah, I think, you know, this question makes me think a lot about risk and return of capital, not just return on capital. So it wouldn't necessarily be my highest returning idea, but I think, you know, a very low risk idea would be one that where they have a very diversified customer base, where they've got multiple products within their business. So they're not just reliant on one product going well. You know, you'd obviously want a fortress balance sheet. You'd want sticky products with pricing power and you'd want great management. And the business that ticks all those boxes for me is Microsoft. You know, they've got three big businesses, the Windows business, the Office business, the Azure cloud business, all of which are in great positions and growing really nicely. They've got some smaller businesses in LinkedIn and Xbox, which are really good little businesses. $70 billion of cash on the balance sheet, you know, probably on 30 times forward earnings, X that cash, not particularly expensive versus other software businesses. And not particularly expensive versus a lot of high-quality ASX-listed businesses. So, I'd buy Microsoft.
And potentially the new owner of TikTok too.
Yeah, that'll be really interesting. I'm keen to see the financial statements of TikTok and find out how much money they're making.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating. Hopefully they break them out from, oh, I guess when they do the acquisition, they'll need to break them out. So yeah, we will get a bit of an insight into that.
Yeah.
But that actually brings us to the end of the interview. Sam, thanks for coming on the show. Been great to hear your thoughts and it's great to have a listener on the show.
Cool, mate. Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Well, that's the end of the show. If you made it this far, I hope that means you enjoyed it. So please follow us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or if you're a LiveWire reader, give this wire a like. Thanks for tuning in.